are going to do both.
But first, I mean, who's Madison? Madison isn't there. Bon, ok. Madison n'est pas là, mais je crois qu'elle parle pas trop français. On a commencé à avoir une conversation il y a 10 jours avec Lisa, et on pensait que ici ça pourrait être un endroit pour poursuivre et en même temps intensifier, revenir sur des choses dont on a parlé un peu plus précisément et essayer de les déplier ici. Pour ce petit événement, on a fait un gâteau avec Rachel qui s'appelle le Kouign-Amann.
C'est un gâteau breton.
Et en fait, c'était un peu une blague aussi par rapport à cette conversation qu'on a eue sur la grâce. En fait, moi, j'ai commencé à parler de musique baroque en lien avec la sensation que je pouvais avoir des textes de Lisa et le rapport à la composition dans la musique baroque. C'est quelque chose qu'on développera après, mais... elle a compris que la grâce était la Grèce, et j'ai commencé à faire des recherches sur quel était le gâteau qui utilisait le plus, quelle était la recette qui utilisait le plus de gras possible. Et on a trouvé que le Kouign-Amann est en fait une utilisation égale du beurre et de la farine. Alors qu'une chose qui sert normalement à lier les choses, comme la graisse ou le beurre, est devenue vraiment un agent aussi important que la farine. Donc voilà, n'hésitez pas à tester. Donc, j'ai pas encore essayé.
Ça ressemble à un Kouign-Amann.
C'est notre premier Kouign-Amann qu'on a fait avec Rachel. Voilà. Donc je pense une des premières choses... On commence, peut-être on attend un petit peu Madison. Ou peut-être on commence, je sais pas. On commence.
C'est comme tu veux.
Je vais me servir un verre d'eau. Attends. Hop, j'en ai un. Donc, un des premiers trucs...
Hello Sam.
Ça, c'est pour toi, ouais.
Et c'est Hello. Ça que tu veux que je...
Oui, ça, je sais bien que c'est cette partie-là.
Ok. J'ai un petit bout que j'ai trouvé. Je vais te montrer. Parce que.
Il faut enregistrer. On a fait un petit bout. Vous enregistrez au téléphone.
Non,
on a oublié le zoom.
Il y a deux versions de ce texte.
De The Collective ?
Oui. Donc, l'autre version commence avec une description.
D'une école ?
Une école.
Super, ouais, ça peut être bien si tu le lis aussi.
Oui,
ok, je pensais. Alors, avant de parler de ce texte collectif que j'ai découvert dernièrement, moi, j'étais partie sur un truc très simple que Lisa avait dit. C'était qu'on parlait de ces poèmes plus anciens que j'étais en train de traduire, et elle a dit que le monde avait changé. Et vu que tout le monde le dit, ça doit être vrai. Je vous disais que...
Depuis j'ai écrit ces poèmes...
Oui, voilà. Et en fait, c'était quelque chose de très simple, et puis c'était un peu resté dans ma mémoire, et en fait, ça m'a fait penser au texte de Gertrude Stein, Composition as Explanation, et que donc a été aussi publié dans ce livre.
On essaie, c'est tellement extraordinaire pour un tout petit texte.
Et oui, je pensais. Juste peut-être par commencer par lire cet extrait en fait que j'ai choisi pour introduire un petit peu la conversation. The only thing that is different from one time to another is what is seen, and what is seen depends upon how everybody is doing everything. This makes the thing we are looking at very different, and this makes what those describe it make of it. It makes a composition. It confuses. It shows. It is. It looks. It likes as it is. And this make what is seen as it is seen. Nothing changes from generation to generation except the thing seen, and that makes a composition. En fait. Madison, you speak French? You don't? Okay. So I'm going to speak English now. Earlier. No, it's okay. But maybe sometime I'm going to switch to French. Okay. Mm-hmm. I read that because I think in your writing, there is maybe I can see a link between the matter of the composition and the way you use the present so much in your text. What is the link between the present and the composition? I mean, if we go on in this text, she also say that she make a comparison between war and art, and she say art and war, we are making are different from the one we are preparing. Mm-hmm. And how the composition can be a work with the present, actually, toward the present, and how the composition is a way to inhabit the present.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a text that I've been reading since I was maybe 25 or so. So I read it a lot 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I reread it at different points, but then I read it again in order to make this book. So big gaps of time went by where I hadn't thought at all about the mm-hmm. text. In the meantime, it seems to me that not consciously, but nevertheless fairly thoroughly, I've integrated her theory of time into the way that I compose. At least as an ideal. I can't say that I've actually mm-hmm. accomplished what she proposes, which mm-hmm. is to stay in the continuous present, mm-hmm. Which she says she does by means of listing? There are various, listing, beginning again, mm-hmm. and there's a third thing. She clearly sets out these three techniques. The essay is actually much more classically structured in terms of its logic mm-hmm. than you might imagine it is when you're absorbed by its style. So she presents these three techniques for remaining in the present during composition. Mm-hmm. And she says that typically works of art are not in the present, as war also is not being composed in the present, that it's being, and she was speaking in the context of the First World War, mm-hmm. that the generals were preparing a different composition of war from the war that actually occurred. Mm-hmm. And rereading this text last year, it really struck me how clear that is in the middle of our current situation of surprise bombings and attacks in major cities, mm-hmm. that there's a composition of war actually going on that nobody is prepared to recognize, because we have a different composition of war in our sort of sense, in our expectations, in our representations of war. Mm. So that was something that's interesting to me about this text in terms of war. Mm-hmm. When I think about how it's influenced my work, I think I've pretty much taken on these techniques that she proposes, mm-hmm. Beginning again,
yeah.
And listing. And perhaps I've taken them on a little bit too heartily at times. Mm-hmm. But she wrote this text in the 39, 41, something like that.
I don't know. Yeah, I didn't check.
It's not really an early... Oh, no, okay, 1926. So kind of in the long beginning of her career. Like, she died in 46.
Yeah.
So she still had 20 years of work ahead of her, but she's also had a big chunk of work behind her. What strikes me reading this now is how she ends it, because it seems to me she gives these... really interesting clues about what's happening in our present right now, because she talks about distribution and equilibrium. I don't even know how to pronounce the word
equilibrium.
Doesn't say equilibrium. Word. It's a word that I know the word, but at the same time, it's one of those words I haven't really said out loud. Does that ever happen to you?
No.
Equilibration.
Equilibration.
Equilibration. I don't think we say that very often in English. It's more like a French word turned into English.
No, it's not.
Does anybody say it in English?
No.
Equilibration.
Just
Gertrude. Okay, so that's why I got it, and I know. Of course, we know what it means. But I didn't know how to say it.
It's a medicine term, and it's exists in French, équilibration.
Okay. Oh, it's from medicine.
Yeah, medicine.
And what does it say? What does it mean?
It's rather fun, so the definition would be in... But
I'd say to make a kind of equal balance, you know? Mm-hmm. I think of distribution as aiming towards this kind of equivalency.
Mm-hmm.
This evenness of, and can you look it up and see what it means?
In
English?
French?
In English? Because she's using it in English. But it seemed to me
to balance equality. So it's a movement of equality, keeping equipoise.
Balance. Yeah.
What is equipoise?
Yes. To be in equilibrium, balance.
Keeping equilibrium. So it's another like force, keeping, like trying to maintain what is equilibrium.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I find it really interesting in terms of contemporary media and economics.
Mm-hmm.
She says, so now one finds oneself interesting oneself in an equilibration. That, of course, means words as well as things and distribution, as well as between themselves, between the words and themselves, and the things and themselves. A distribution as distribution.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I think of my, I think, fairly typically obsessive relationship with the internet, you know, we're constantly in this state of distribution as distribution. There's an ongoing evenness of distribution of so-called information or images or linguistic units, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so just reading this essay a couple of times on the train on the way here, I was surprised at how forward-looking it seemed when she sort of describes what the next problem will be.
Mm-hmm.
And... you know, basically the problem that she describes as being her problem of how to be in the present by means of beginning again and listing is not the same as the problem we have, because mm-hmm. history has changed, the political economy has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And yet she ends this essay by talking about what the current problem might be.
Mm-hmm.
And... anyways,
but I think, for me, this text is still contemporary, and I think I came to be interested in it because the way in the art is so hard to actually don't work in the project, you know, to just the organization of art, and I mean, she kind of oppose also what can be academic art to what is art mm-hmm. in the making.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that to work with the composition, and there are so much proposals, you know, to like being in a context and to do art in the context, but still you have to prepare. And this idea like to write a project that is so different that just extend your research actually, keep going mm-hmm. what you are doing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, when I saw this text, it's also the fact that it started saying that there is singularly nothing that makes a difference between the beginning and in the middle and the end. I mean, it was just like it can be totally contemporary text mm-hmm. for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to come back to the thing that I make a link, maybe I make it up. With the present, the importance of the present in your text and the relationship to the composition, to Gertrude Stein, you say in Arsbot, I want to distribute the present.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can...
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a little bit uncanny rereading this now and seeing seeing how my own language has kind of cycled out of this and recombined parts of her sentences and so on and so forth. This idea of the present in itself as containing with it every ingredient necessary in order to continue, and that containing as being in itself potentially radical, is a thinking that I was carrying out for many years alongside Matthew Stadler, mm-hmm. who I edited this Revolution, A Reader, with. And it had to do a lot with what I was doing when I was writing the soft architecture essays, mm-hmm. trying to notice in the city I was in the present, right now, mm-hmm. among the banality, mm-hmm. etc., what was already other, mm-hmm. what was already becoming something else. But what I noticed, and so that idea has become very familiar to me, and it's been very useful for me because it gives me something to do wherever I am. But it's also a completely typical idea when it comes to speaking of literary modernity. Mm-hmm. It's the main idea of Baudelaire, for example, mm-hmm. to begin where you are, mm-hmm. in the city, where you are, begin with the most banal surroundings and find what is beautiful, what is new, what is transformative, mm. what is potentially radical, right in that texture of the given everyday.
But I'm not that... Oh, sorry.
So yeah, that's been an idea that I return to in different ways at different times, and it's a kind of thing that is really... It's easy to repeat, but it can be difficult to recognize when you're actually within, when you're within the process of working on something, writing something. Mm-hmm. It can be difficult to actually recognize how to deploy that thought, and so it's one of those ideas that constantly, for me, has to be reactivated, mm-hmm. over and over. And every time I encounter this as a problem in my writing, it seems like a new problem.
Yeah.
And then once again, I have to discover this idea of the present and there already, the fact that there already is everything,
yeah.
right there.
I don't know about the beginning thing, but the present, I mean, for me, it's really linked also to what condition are you creating to write, actually. You know, it's not the fact of having something to work about. And it's so hard for me to say that I'm working about something. But this idea that in the composition, like the way she speaks of it, mm-hmm. Forgetting this modernist idea is also like how you de-hierarchize.
I don't know how you pronounce it. De-hierarchize?
Yeah.
I can no longer speak any language. So.
Oh my God. We know that word in English, de-hierarchize.
I don't know.
There is a hierarchy and you undo the hierarchy.
Deconstruct?
Maybe. Yeah, yes. Deconstruct. actually the way things come to you, you know, and also being available to... what happened actually, and to concentrate on where you are focusing, mm-hmm. and it's not yeah. the thing like what happened in the street, you know. It's not only that, but it's a certain way of opening.
Well, there it presents a series of interesting problems that can expand to become techniques, and one is simply in the choice of subject matter. How do you know what to write about? You know, what's interesting? How do you go about choosing what your material is?
Mm.
What your lexicon is? What are you looking at? So that's a basic problem.
It's a very basic problem.
Yeah, sure. But it repeats itself too, because it's really easy to be very self-critical and go, oh, that's not interesting, or to let go of the idea before it has the time to get interesting,
yeah.
or to not even recognize what it is that's already in your experience that merits a representation. So there's that problem. that's an interesting recurrent problem. And then there's the problem when you're actually writing of not sort of going to find ways of not going beyond your material to make judgments mm-hmm. about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And to shape it according to an external and familiar subordinate narrative structure, and how to stay within it, how to go back within the material always. So while composing, you're not going beyond the material, but you're finding ways to return to the mess in the middle of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so those two problems are, they're not the same problem, but they're both recurring in different sort of proportions.
Mm-hmm. So actually, I went back to this text because I discovered The Collective recently. And I think I asked you last time, like, it was not a question. I said, like, I was asking myself, actually, is it like an answer or a kind of activation of what Gertrude Stein say about the composition and how to create a composition? And so I was thinking if you can read just an sure. extract.
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think I'll just say about it before I read this little extract.
Yeah.
I'll say that I was specifically seeking to represent a time in my life when I worked very intensely in Vancouver with a collective of writers. And it was maybe a little bit like the cheapest university, you know, really low budget, much shittier premises than this.
Yeah, it seems
not this fancy.
We are so
but, you know, people sitting around a table trying to figure out how to work and how to think, and people donating their time and living on next to nothing, doing very menial work in order to have their minds free for the collective work. And so this was a group I was involved with for, you know, 15 years or so, about, during the time when I was really shaping my work. And I wrote this text last fall for a conference was about the relationship between poetry and conceptual art in Vancouver. And so the conference gave me the opportunity to sort of think, oh, that period when I was working with the Kootenay School of Writing, which we just called KSW, mm-hmm. and Kootenay is a mountain range and also a brand of beer. I suddenly saw it as being something and not just part of a, you know, inevitably muddled personal history, but as being something possibly interesting for the present. And so I started to kind of see this collective experience as a composition in itself. So my decision to try to represent that both sort of does and doesn't have to do with what Stein was saying, because this is a period from my past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's mm-hmm. it's
yeah, yeah.
It's kind of like self historicizing
yeah.
in a certain way.
Yeah.
But I decided I wanted to do it because I felt that the way that this text ends is with a question, which seems to me remains the most driving question. And so I'll read this very little tiny final paragraph, because it sets up what the proposition is and why this representation of this collective moment might be interesting in the present. A question remains open. What is the relation between the poem and a form of life? What are the terms and means of this vital translation? I believe that this is the query that the collective elaborated and refined. So just that question, what is the relation between the poem and a form of life?
Mm-hmm.
And what this text seeks to do is to describe the form of life from which the poetry emerged. So the part that Sabrina wanted me to read is this part. I was never a founder. For certain periods, I was absent. My interpretation of events corresponds to my own heightened, even hackneyed, desire for a story. I never felt really equal to the magnetism of my companions. This account is quite wrong factually. As for the forms of protest, often they were unrecognizable, except belatedly. And that's something that really interests me, is this idea of belated recognition, because that seems to be the main rule of my own experience. But it also becomes a kind of mode of composing, the idea of a belated recognition. The most stringent protest evades spectacle, nonchalantly preserving its transformative force for the propitious moment, the most apt and unsuspecting initiates, the casually secretive gathering. Some of them believed the resurgence pertained to syntax and adored repeating that word. Some believed in the complicated and conflictual process of group consensus as a model for change. Yet who they kissed or didn't, how long the empties sat, the fruit flies hovering above them, the way the notebooks splayed across the stained blue carpet for days at a time. The books never returned to the library, and the books found lying on sidewalks. The borrowing and filching and thrifting. The use of letraset, glue stick, and carbon paper in their quotidian rituals. The Smith Corona Selectric that came after the loud manual. The placement of the folded bath towel under the manual late at night to protect the shared wooden house from staccato retort. The use of roach chalk on thresholds. Listing. These exigencies necessarily infiltrated their grammar. And grammar pertained not only to linguistic coherence and distribution and its invention, but to community and domestic form. They practiced the evasion of enforced subordination in favor of horizontal structures of distribution, composition, and exchange. Their task was very large, like a decades-long emotional science project. They believed they would be endlessly robust. They believed the same for their texts. And then I'm just going to read one more little bit of it that was from a different version. This version that Sabrina printed out is from the Harriet website that the Poetry Foundation publishes. But I basically split a longer piece into two pieces so I could publish in two different places.
That's great. <right.
laughs> You know? So there are a couple of paragraphs that went into a Canadian art magazine, and I'm going to read this one paragraph just because it explains what my perception is of what we meant by school, because that's one of the things we were going to talk about.
Yeah.
So the actual beginning of this piece went like this. A school alit on a moment. It felt electric, erotic, uncomfortable, necessary. Because they noticed, the moment expanded, scaffolded by a low-rent materiality. They entered this temporal suspension by climbing narrow and steep stairways to the upper floors of neglected Edwardian storefronts in a decrepit downtown neighborhood. They trundled book boxes or helped the older ones. But beyond the scaffolding and the dusty scent of the hallways, the school itself was immaterial and infinitely mobile, like many of its precedents. Single Black Mountain lectures sprawling magnificently across days. Beer-fueled living room readings attended by loggers, architects, camp cooks, lefty lawyers, and students. The communal meeting halls of 1871 Paris in the month of March, where radical shoemakers, seamstresses, and preschool teachers lectured on citizenship. The experimental chemistry clubs of 17th century revolutionary London, the romantic meteorologists of Cambridgeshire, Fourier's passionate associations in phalansteries, the peripatetic conversance of the Epicurean garden, where women and men shared the lively and living pursuit of philosophy in contradiction to the discourses of the state. When this was published in a Canadian art magazine, and the fact checker asked me to prove that there were experimental chemistry clubs in 17th century London, and they wanted to know who were the romantic meteorologists of Cambridgeshire, because an art magazine has to have real facts.
Okay.
Furthermore, it was published as fiction, so it's great. The fact checker moving in on the fiction.
Yeah.
But the history.
The fact that you are using they is mm-hmm. a thing that I notice also, and that makes this community at some point, when you read the text, abstract also. I mean, there are things, there are dates that, like, you really situate the duration even mm-hmm. of the collective and everything. But, I mean, you just follow... And I mean, when I was actually following the description, that more list, actually, mm-hmm. I was really more into something that is elaborating in the present. I'm reading it.
Mm-hmm.
So the they, I was thinking, like, it's weird because if she was a part of it, like, she suddenly takes this position. And you say it also in the introduction of the text that it needs, like, a kind of distance to tell what happened, actually. Mm-hmm. But they, I would say, is also the way we create history. Because who's historian who going to say we, you know?
Yeah.
It's usually they say they. This is what they do. This is what...
It's assuming a kind of slightly false objectivity to say they.
But it's a little push, I think, toward the, like, making history, actually,
mm-hmm.
that I kind of enjoy. And... yeah, I was thinking, can I read this French part I translated?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I also like it. It's qui a embrassé qui a corrigé les textes, qui a collectionné avec qui, dans quel, qui a collaboré avec qui, dans quel studio, qui ont emménagé ensemble et quel groupe a fait siffler leurs oreilles pendant des jours après les concerts. Qui s'est engueulé dans la cuisine et aux tables de bar sur le recueil alphabétique de l'analyse politique? Impossible de séparer ces questions de mon imagination de ces espaces. Ils appréciaient la sensation d'être mordus par une idée. Ils fleurissaient dans l'ambiance défensive. L'ambiguïté, la catexis et les disputes étaient des expressions d'amour et de haine collectif, où l'amour et la haine changeaient de siège avec une minutie toujours inattendue. Toutes les soirées, réunions, toute table même pouvaient prétendre au caractère d'une éruption. J'ai entendu dire « Quelqu'un a frappé quelqu'un alors qu'il fumait dans la rue entre deux lectures. Un qui écrivait des sonnets au scotch tape, l'autre qui inventait des coalitions virtuelles. Un qui travaille tout le temps, l'autre qui a disparu. De même que la disparition, l'ennui partagé était un contenu. » And I wasn't sure if c'est la content hors contenu. Chaque mois, il passait plus de temps voûté au-dessus du long formica marron, gueule de bois, pliant deux fois des feuilles de papier de 8 par 11 pour les faire entrer dans des enveloppes format standard, alors que l'odeur de bière rassie dégoulinait des coins. C'était les communiqués de presse tapés sur la sélectrique et gâtés de blanco. Consensus décidé par leurs auteurs même lors de longues et fréquentes réunions méandrées. Il en était de même pour les listes de lecteurs, de conférenciers, des leaders de workshops, d'organisateurs de tables rondes et toutes les autres choses. I like the materiality of this text, I think. And when I was reading it, I was just like, okay, the collective is not only people, and people are also bodies.
Mm.
You know, and I really like also the whiteout. There are a lot of things about the whiteout.
This is technology that now is kind of quaint, that we actually still use typewriters at the beginning, and so whiteout and there was no email, so to send a press release, you had to fill an envelope. So
yeah.
All of that technology now, which was just banal and unremarkable,
yeah,
now becomes... And I had to explain to somebody a couple of weeks ago what Letraset is,
yeah,
which we would often use Letraset to, you know, on photocopied scenes and stuff like that. So, you know, one thing that it's possible to do is just to make a kind of record of the disappeared recent past. Like, what materiality, you know, what did mm-hmm. we do with our hands?
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed... it didn't seem interesting to me as we were doing it. What was interesting to me then was, you know, discovering Judith Butler and arguing about Homi Bhabha and, you know, reading Lynn Hejinian and stuff like that. That's what was interesting to me. But, and that doesn't stop being interesting, but in retrospect, what is particular are these sort of vanished materialities and these very minor techniques which actually cause the social intensity to continue to produce itself.
Mm-hmm. What I find interesting also is that when it's concerning the communication actually, because I think like the collective of what we are doing here also with Chippus University. Is this thing we are always struggling with the communication, you know,
yeah.
and the fact that it's not material also, and the fact that, I mean, it seemed that you also said that, like, we decide the way we want to communicate with people
yeah.
and find a form for that,
yeah.
you know, find
yeah.
a form for that.
And that takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
And a lot of argument.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. yeah.
We argue a lot. Constantly in disagreement, what seems totally logical and self-evident to three people, to four other people, is just wrong.
Yeah.
And so you discover that with yeah. people who you respect and really, you know, really like and whose minds you love, you discover that it's actually not possible to communicate about certain things. And it's shocking. And that becomes an interesting thing, you know.
Yeah.
That's actually part of cultural and political and effective life.
Sure. But how much are you, in terms of numbers, like 10 or you said
something? 10 would be the biggest,
okay.
like for the actual working collective.
Mm-hmm.
At events, there would be anywhere between 10 and 70,
yeah.
depending, you know.
But to like manage the school?
Usually 6 or 8.
6 or 8?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We are good, I think.
And sometimes it would dwindle down to 4 and that would get tense.
Oh, yeah.
But if it got too big, that also made it hard to make decisions.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but at the same time, you don't want to prevent people from joining.
Yeah.
So you don't want to be closed. So there's a
yeah.
very difficult balance.
It's a thing we discuss a lot also with Chippus University, like how we... like open to people, but at some point never like keep in mind how we can still being able to manage the structure
yeah.
really, you know.
Yeah.
And what it means to be involved in something.
Yeah.
And how people can be involved in what is here, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what are the action to be involved? Like what?
I know.
How. You know.
One of the things that we used to come up with is there were people who wanted to be involved who it became clear, sometimes quickly, sometimes more slowly, were thinking of writing and thinking along a more professionalized thread, and were thinking that their involvement with the collective was a kind of form of self-promotion.
Okay, yeah.
Or career promotion.
Yeah.
That was really different from the kind of texture of argument that we were actually interested in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, promotion was the kind of language that we would have to use on grant applications
yeah.
in order to get money from the city or the province.
Yeah.
And it became really offensive to hear people taking on that sort of commercial language.
Mm-hmm.
as actually being part of what they wanted to do with their minds and their language in the present.
Yeah.
And so we had to kind of figure out ways of kind of blocking those people out.
Sure.
And that's where it got mean.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So it wasn't always a kind, kind collective.
So
there was a lot of unkindness.
Yeah, you talk about that in the text.
Yeah,
you say they didn't like things, or something like that.
A real group identity can be formed around what people hate together, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know? Whether you're talking about a style or an economy or...
Yeah, sure. You know. So, what I was thinking, it's also interesting the way in your own writing you often use metaphor of schools. I don't know if metaphor is a good
word. No, I think it's good,
yeah. There is this sentence it's in the last book, in Three Summer. Is it your last book? In Three Summer, there are a lot of things about the school, actually.
Yeah, there are a lot of school things in there.
Yeah. And so there is, I like this one. Where were you last night in a school among the pine? I start a school called How Can I Live? I really like this one.
Yeah.
And there is things also about what is learning that is different from maybe a will to know, right?
Yeah. During the years I was writing most of the poems in Three Summers, I was reading a lot of Pierre Hadot, who is a historian of pre-Platonic Greek philosophy, and specifically of the Epicurean and Stoic and Cynic schools of philosophy. And I was very, very moved by his description, particularly of Epicureanism, which I had an interest in already because of my studies in Lucretius and atomism. I was interested in the way he described as Epicurean school as being an experiment in how to live, how to produce happiness. It's just very moving and meaningful to me, especially in the current climate of the kind of economic rationalization of higher education that most people who work or study in university are dealing with in different ways. And my own relationship with higher education is kind of, I don't have a permanent position anywhere, so I have a pretty privileged relationship in that I kind of drift in and out of it for short contracts. So I don't often actually have to participate in the administrative bullshit that makes it increasingly miserable to have a full-time job in those things. But I'm aware of it because of what my colleagues, my friends, and what Jean-Philippe tells me, and it's there. So I guess I have an interest in producing a different concept of what a school can be.
Yeah, and it feels very...
And like holding on to some extremely idealist and horizontal and passionate notion of a school.
Yeah, I think that's what... It's also sometimes funny, actually. Yeah. And there was this sentence I tried to think more about, but I I don't know still what to say about it. You could say that form is learning. I don't know if you remember, I told you this sentence, and if you thought more about it or if you have something to... I don't know. Because there is still something that I understand, but I don't. I mean, I get it, but I don't at some point.
To me, the kind of the important query in this is less about the learning
that which is a more of a tentative go at describing at what form might be doing, but the important part of that sentence, you could say that form is learning, is the question about what is form.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a question that circles around any poetry writing. You know, I mean, poetry writing is some kind of... there's always some kind of relationship between language and form, whether it's a rejection of traditional forms or an invention of new forms, but there's always the question of form in poetry. And I just, over time, have become interested in trying to describe for myself just what form is. How do we recognize form as form? And it's a philosophical question, which also becomes a compositional and a linguistic question. And an essay that I've been reading for a super long time, over and over and over, that has helped me the most thinking about a more opened and dynamic and process-based thinking of form is Emile Benveniste, French linguist's essay on the concept of rhythm, where he talks about the history of the Greek concept of rhythmos, separate from its conventional etymology and contemporary meaning, which has come to meant a kind of a temporal regular alteration, such as the beating of waves, etc., waves on a beach, you know, all of the concept of rhythm that we have currently is developed gradually over time.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes to an earlier point in the history of thinking to find a different meaning for the term rhythm, when in... the thought of the atomists, for example, particularly Democritus, who was an atomist thinker, rhythm or rhythmos meant form. But it meant form not as something fixed or rigid, as we tend to think of form now, as something set. It didn't mean form as a bounded structure. It meant, rhythmos meant form as a living process of movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so I brought a quotation from this.
Yeah.
But I just brought the French because I thought that we were supposed to be speaking French. But I kind of not really doing that, am I? But neither are you. But anyways, so I brought this... wonderful quotation from this Benveniste essay, which I'll read in my lousy French. So he spells the word out in Greek letters in his text, but the Greek word is rhythmos, which I don't know if that's really how you pronounce it. If Democritus said rhythmos the way
rhythmos?
I did. Rhythmos? Who knows? But there's this kind of th letter. I don't even know what the Greek letters are called.
Yeah, I don't speak Greek.
I know how to pronounce them roughly. I mean, I taught myself how to pronounce them when I was like 22. So I've made up Greek. Okay. Rhythmos. D'après le contexte où il est donné, désigne la forme dans l'instant qu'elle est assumée par ce qui est mouvant, mobile, fluide, la forme de ce qui n'a pas consistance organique. Il convient au pattern d'un élément fluide, à une lettre arbitrairement modelée, à un peplos, peplos c'est une espèce d'un jupe grec, c'est un vêtement, à une peplos qu'on arrange à son gré, à la disposition particulière du caractère ou de l'humeur. C'est la forme improvisée, momentanée, modifiable. Or, Rhine, c'est le racine du mot rhythmos, et c'est un peu comme la rivière, c'est ce qui coule.
Mm-hmm.
C'est ce qui coule.
Le courant.
Oui, c'est l'eau qui coule.
Le flow, courant. Alors. Le flow.
Oui, mm-hmm. Oui. Mais par contre, ce ne sont pas les flottes.
Les flottes. Qu'est-ce que les flottes?
Waves.
Ah, les vagues.
Ce ne sont pas des vagues.
Oui, les vagues sont différentes du courant.
Oui, voilà. C'est oui, ça qu'ils oui. discutent. Ils discutent oui. les différences entre ce qui coule et ce qui et les vagues qui frappent.
C'est un verbe. Rhein.
Rhein?
C'est un
oui.
verbe.
Oui, ok.
C'est l'infinitif.
Or, Rhein est le prédicat essentiel de la nature et des choses dans la philosophie ionienne depuis Héraclite et Démocrite, pensant que tout étant produit par les atomes, seul leur arrangement différent produit la différence des formes et des objets. On peut alors comprendre que rhythmos signifiant littéralement manière particulière de flouer, ait été le terme le plus propre à décrire des dispositions ou des configurations sans fixité ni nécessité naturelle et résultant d'un arrangement toujours sujet à changer. Le choix d'un dérivé de Rhein pour exprimer cette modalité spécifique de la forme des choses et caractéristiques de la philosophie qui l'inspire. C'est une représentation de l'univers où les configurations particulières du mouvement se définissent comme des flouements. Il y a une liaison profonde entre le sens propre du terme rhythmos et la doctrine dont il décèle une des notions les plus originales. Donc, cet passage m'a tellement frappé depuis des années. C'est que récemment que je l'ai lu en français. Mais ce livre est traduit en 71, je crois. Mm-hmm. Donc,
en anglais.
En anglais.
Ouais.
Et c'était traduit avant la dernière maladie de Benveniste. Donc, il a participé dans la traduction lui-même. Donc, mm-hmm. on peut assumer qu'on a une bonne traduction.
Bonne traduction
là. Oui. En tout cas, cette idée que la forme, c'est une chose qui est toujours en mouvement, toujours en transformation. La forme, c'est la transformation.
Oui, voilà, c'est ce raccourci-là, en fait, que oui. je trouve assez intéressant.
Oui.
Et en fait,
oui. Donc, depuis ouais. des années maintenant, j'essaie de vraiment comprendre ce que ça veut dire.
Mm-hmm.
Et j'ai fait des expériences, des expériments pour... essayer de trouver cette idée.
Mm-hmm.
Parce que je ne peux pas vraiment dire que je comprends,
mm-hmm.
mais j'ai une volonté de comprendre. Donc, ouais. une phrase comme tu as cité, « You can say that form is learning », ça représente plutôt une espèce d'une volonté, un essai vers
mm-hmm.
une compréhension qui va toujours continuer à changer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually get an idea. Pardon, je ne sais pas pourquoi je parle.
C'est pour Madison en anglais.
Yeah. That it was more linked to the composition thing and the thing that we were speaking in the beginning.
Mais c'est la même chose. Composition
yeah.
et rythme.
Yeah,
c'est
sure,
la même chose.
Sure. Yeah.
Oui, et transformation.
Yeah. And I. Because I was thinking in terms of how composition can be a task for the poem. And I wrote this thing that I have also used in one of my poems. I was thinking like, okay, the task of the poet can be maybe to argue with Galilei that the world is not round, but the world is around.
Uh-huh.
You know, just this idea to transform
what is actually approved as like a form, like the earth, you know, in something it's more linked to actually the context of how you interact, actually, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. how the world is not like around, but like more around, like mean the interaction, actually, how we can mm-hmm. understand.
We yeah. come see you around.
See you around, yeah. Okay. Yeah. One of the first thing I told you when I wrote you the first email I wrote to you, I think I told you that in Cyprus University and in the workshop I'm running, was that we were trying to bring on the table poetic approaches dealing with teaching, learning, knowing, and not mm-hmm. knowing issues. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's how I came to became interested in yeah. work, somehow, I think. And mm-hmm. I was translating early education at that moment. And I like the way that this poem somehow is... I mean, it's not the coming-of-age story, you know, but the idea of, like, how you can write with about education or... Mm-hmm. And the fact that you told me you use, actually, the translation... It was an experimental translation yeah. of Saint Augustin.
Yes.
And so can you talk a little bit about that? Can you talk a little bit about that? And, I mean, in terms of how you, the translation for you can be a way to appropriate text.
Okay, there's several different parts of questions there.
Yeah, I know. That's my way to ask questions.
So the question that's about education and learning
yeah.
is actually a little bit different than the question that is about Saint Augustin.
Yeah.
Because when... You know, when he says education, it's not really, it's more like education in the French sense of very young children becoming themselves. How one is sort of, you know, trained as a child to become a person. So it's different from the sense of, you know, schooling and learning, where the way in English we currently use that word. Like, we talk about higher education, and in French that would be more like des études, or mm-hmm. something like that. So they're kind of like two separate concepts. And I am interested in experimental education, absolutely. And that comes through my my history of working with an experimental collective and teaching collaboratively and being very influenced by Charles Olson and the Black Mountain College and kinds of radical experiments in education, and also by that incredible book translated into English by Kristen Ross called The Ignorant Schoolmaster mm-hmm. It's a book by Jacques Rancière.
Yeah.
And it's about a guy whose name I forget right now who lived...
Yeah.
And he had this theory of teaching where the teacher actually didn't have to know anything. And the teacher was there to facilitate the intelligence already inherent in every mm-hmm. student. Mm-hmm. And the way to facilitate this intelligence is not to take a power position of telling them what they should know, but finding ways to help them recognize what they already know. So I found that like a really moving description and hopefully even handbook of how one might teach. And difficult handbook to follow because one is always tempted to, you know, construct a position of power by, showing off accumulated knowledge.
Yeah.
Facts, etc.
Yeah.
A bibliography, and to kind of let go of that hierarchical relationship to a group, and find a way to facilitate an ambience of learning which is non-hierarchical and begins with the assumption of each person's completely intact and innate intelligence and ability. That's really interesting to me. I mean, teaching's one of the things I do to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you sort of try, and I teach mostly in art schools, so there's a lot of freedom
mm-hmm.
in how I set things up, you know,
mm-hmm.
so people are pretty open,
mm-hmm.
open-minded about their expectations. So that really interests me. But the thing with writing that text, I wasn't actually thinking about teaching and pedagogy at all. I was just trying to translate this St. Augustine text because I was interested in confessions
mm-hmm.
as a form. And it was a time when I'd been reading Rousseau and Augustine and Montaigne and was just interested in the form of confession. And I was also at that time reading, I wouldn't say a lot, but in a patchy way, reading psychoanalysis, and was interested in analyses of power within the formation of subjects. And so I guess this is where these two ideas do come together. So in my translation of the beginning part of St. Augustine's Confession, where he's talking about his early childhood, I became interested to reveal and to almost make a caricature of relationships of power
mm-hmm.
Between children and adults and children and institutions
mm-hmm.
and so on and so forth. And I sort of, in making my translation, I kind of playfully eroticized these power transactions. I imagined that I was Kathy Acker translating...
Yeah, you said that. Yeah,
translating St. Augustine. Now, what would she have done?
Yeah,
and it seemed to me that she would awkwardly eroticize all power.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I set out to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, reading your work and the fact that you are translating. And you are using pronoun, and you play with pronoun.
Mm-hmm.
And I make a link with those two things: the fact that you can say I for someone else. And I was thinking mostly about cinema of the present and the you,
mm-hmm.
and there is I also in cinema.
There's there's a little bit of
I.
Yeah.
But actually the way you are using translation and the way you are using pronoun in your work.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cinema of the Present is probably an interesting text to talk about in that regard because it's a text that after I had a full draft of the entire manuscript, I changed the pronoun.
Oh, you changed it?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it started out that this was a manuscript that said she,
mm-hmm.
because I had a strong desire to represent women's subjectivity
mm-hmm.
in a very overt way. And she is a pronoun that I had mostly always avoided because it seemed to have a kind of cloying, traditionally feminizing kind of aura around it. And also, a woman writer saying she is almost always assumed to be speaking about herself.
Yeah.
And I just hated that kind of expectation that a reader might bring to a text. So I'd always avoided it. So I thought that it would be interesting to try to use it because I had avoided it for so long.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote this book in order to try to say she. And so wherever you see you, it was she.
Yeah.
And I realized that it didn't work when I finished it. There was something kind of flat about it. There's something...
About the you mean?
No, about the she.
The she, yeah, okay.
There's something, it just like, it was just flat. It didn't... All I can say is it didn't work. That's a slightly mysticizing statement, but there is some sort of way in which the language did not lift, and it was not a successful experiment. And so I left it for some time, and as ever, I was reading a lot of Benveniste, and I was reading his essays on subjectivity and pronouns. And he has a theory of pronouns where I and you are the only real pronouns because they produce one another, and they're always in a dynamic of interchange. One can only become I when speaking to a you who becomes I in her turn, etc. So this really dynamic description of subjectivity through an interchange of pronoun identity really excited me. And suddenly I thought, well, that's the problem with my book. She is simply descriptive, whereas I and you are dynamic. Mm-hmm. So I decided that rather than what I had ended up writing was a kind of description of a feminized subjectivity rather than an enactment of it. And I decided to systematically go through my entire manuscript and change every female third person pronoun to you. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I had done that, the thing kind of came alive. One of the, it was already a full book-length manuscript, so it was quite a lot of work to go through, change it all. So I made mistakes in my, and I decided to leave quite a lot of the mistakes in.
Okay.
So there are little traces of the feminine in there that kind of break through or are kind of undercurrents. Mm-hmm. And when it was translated into French, Pascal Poirier and I discussed it and decided that the second person pronoun would be feminine mm-hmm. in the French translation. Mm-hmm. And so it is.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it really changed something because the you is also really like an address, you know. So mm-hmm. it really turns the book for me, was really the question of the address, because what you say about the she, actually, I don't know, I'm sorry, but I was thinking like she is speaking to herself. Sometimes, mm-hmm. I mean, it was very weird because sometimes
I didn't escape.
No, but I like it anyway. What to say? But it's because actually there is this ambiguity that you mm-hmm. can. First of all, I was thinking like she addressed to the actually history of cinema, to the history of or the material history of film. Mm-hmm. Also because there are all those things about a gate made of... Mm-hmm. And I was really thinking, like, this is raccord. What is his name for that? Raccord? You know, when there is a scene and you have another scene, and in between there is...
Montage?
It's not montage.
Cut.
It's the cut, transition. But un raccord, it's like a transition, actually. It's more like a transition... A splice. No. Mm. Yeah.
It's like a join. It's one of those words that doesn't totally translate.
Yeah.
I know it from house renovation.
It's
how
splice,
two materials
splice,
meet one another.
Splice would be the best word, I think, to say. Like, from one scene to another, there is like a kind of a gate, or I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking also because there are all the thing that, because there is this title and there are inside situation that I can identify to movies, I was thinking it is a I who is addressing herself to the cinema, actually, to the history of the cinema. And then I was thinking, no, she's addressing to herself. And I think, no, she's addressing to the lover, actually. Mm-hmm. So it's all this movement between what the address can be, evaluate.
What I like about it is its mobility.
Yeah.
That it isn't any one of those things only,
yeah.
but that it moves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should we read a little passage? I select
sure.
a little passage.
Sure.
Could you? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a short passage. I choose this one, but I mean, you can start before if you want. Or
show me where to start. So are we reading it together?
No, you're reading it.
Oh, no, we need two voices.
Oh, we need two voices. Okay, let's
yeah.
go. Okay.
Okay, so will you start or will I start?
I will start.
Okay.
But duration isn't linear.
Your tradition, the dried-out green bottle fly dangling from a web like an earring.
But you are not Mademoiselle Falconetti face.
The pools of bile on the floor of the operating theater glinting beneath heavenly lamps.
But you did not disappear to yourself.
You rest just to the side of this great, innocent, manipulated faith in the individual will.
But you have not been educated to use it.
What is a pronoun but a metaphor?
But you will wedge open the artificial and malleable caesura for a moment longer.
You'll see.
But your desire is not an instrument.
You become the girl who swims underwater.
But your theory of rest begins at the horizon.
Because you could express yourself with your face, it had become your face.
By means of description, a world profound mouth of time became your milieu.
You are insistent about the uncovering of this potential indifference.
Carnations and peat moss and a collapsing wall.
Who are you in relation to this woman?
Certainly you have aspired to thoroughness.
You feel minute perceptions speeding across a dirty surface.
Coded eyebrow late night.
Your subject shouldn't be rationed, but expressed as the traversal of this surface.
Coming to this place, looking out over the passing container yards, the cranes like fractured Trojan animals, you are carved out by sadness and roads and the entire moving sky of history.
You wanted to see an image that had never been seen before.
Could it be over already?
Grief harms the spleen.
Could you be the historian of the future?
Speak, tiny, expensive morning.
Curiosity, limbs, and momentum, because of form you keep playing.
Expose yourself to the sensitive paper.
That's great to read it with two voices. I like it. Okay, so, I select this passage, because I think also the book for me was how you can identify to something. There is this
identify with something
with someone actually mm-hmm. more
yeah.
with
yeah.
someone
yeah.
more
yeah.
with someone and there is there is this who are you in relation to this woman and but you did not disappear to yourself and further you become the girl who swim underwater. And I think that's also the part where I was thinking about the title Cinema of the Present and how in cinema it plays, you know, with identification and
mm-hmm.
so, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when I was starting to write the work that I began to publish in, late 80s, early 90s, my friends and I were reading a lot of feminist film criticism, like Teresa de Laredes and Laura Mulvey.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about narrative and identification and pleasure in cinema. And so those discussions about pleasure and identification as being kind of feminist stances really helped me begin to get into my writing in a different way. That wasn't consciously what I was thinking about when I wrote this, a million years later. What I was consciously thinking about when I wrote this was the works of Pedro Costa, this Portuguese experimental filmmaker. And I can't say that what I have done bears any direct relationship to Pedro Costa, but this phrase, the cinema of the present, comes from him, hearing him talk about
mm-hmm.
his work.
Mm-hmm.
I saw sort of all of his films all at once at a film festival in Berkeley when I was living there, and he was there giving lectures about it. So I had this experience of total immersion in Pedro Costa's work and the way he talked about it. And it was at the time when I was just beginning to write this book, and I thought that I didn't realize that this book was that project. I had this title, Cinema of the Present, and I wanted to write a book called Cinema of the Present. And it wasn't until I finished this book that I realized that this was that book. So there was kind of like diverging textual desires that later reconnected.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't consciously trying to achieve what Pedro Costa achieved, and yet there's something unrelenting about his gaze that reveals something about human relationships that I find really, really very moving. Like, for example, in his film In Vonda's Room, where he's just focusing. He's mostly shot in one single room, this tiny bedroom, this young woman named Vonda, and it's about people just coming and visiting her and talking with her, and often they're smoking heroin together or something like this. So it's very difficult to watch because it's very... from a certain point of view, it seems very destructive, very, very, very hard. And it's very difficult to not sort of project, you know, judgments into, you know, choices that are being represented. But from another point of view, there is this freedom of human relationship and the way she talks with people. And in the way that she... and she worked with Pedro Costa to make the film. So she was a real person named Vonda who collaborated with him in the formation of this film because she believed that he was not showing relationships and subjectivity in women's lives the way that they actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, well, fine, let's make a film together. And so she worked with him to make this film about, in part, about her relationships, all carried out in this single confining room, pretty much, on the outskirts of Lisbon. And so there's just something relentless about the project that I found incredibly moving, and I think that kind of gave me a bit of courage to make a book as relentless as this book. I mean, there are no breaks. It's a single book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a single formal gesture that holds the whole thing together.
Mm-hmm.
There are no departures from it. There's no space.
Yeah.
So I was interested in that sort of formal relentlessness and what it could show about subjectivity. So in that sense, it was influenced by Pedro Costa quite a lot.
I was thinking to actually come back to this link. I mean, the way I talk about some of your writing that have like a result of experimental translation. Oh, I was thinking of like the story, actually, the fact that I discover googling some sentences of the story
mm-hmm.
that it was actually the Odyssey behind.
Yeah.
I was just like, wow, that's so funny, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, it also brought me more into this thing that we discussed a little bit, the fact that you are often using also epic and male literature to appropriate. And it's not like only the thing like to appropriate, I don't know, for the history or for something. It's more like turning something that is produced like by male classic literature that you turn and you say, I, in that place, I mean, in, you turn this thing.
Yeah, that's true. Well, my first three books were modeled after the Virgilian triad. So there's a book of pastoral, a book of Georgic, and an epic.
Yeah.
So I kind of consciously did that, but in a very broad pastiche like way. It was really influenced by 18th century kind of mock epic and this sort of ironical or satirical assumption of classical form to say something about the present. I was very influenced by Alexander Pope and also by Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, who was a poet who was a colleague of Pope's. So this my interest in 18th century satire gave me an access to classical literature, and at that point, particularly Virgil. And it, frankly, at the time, it was just sort of amusing to speak in that voice. And I, my own education was really not classical in any way at all. So I'd never, you know, I'd never studied Virgil at school. I'd never read Virgil ever before. You know, I mean, what got me to Virgil was Frank O'Hara and Alexander Pope. So kind of a weird pathway, because Frank O'Hara was writing eclogues. Like, what's an eclogue? So I discovered through Frank O'Hara that, you know, Lady Mary Wortley Montagu wrote eclogues in the 18th century, et cetera, et cetera. So I found my way into these, you know, very authoritative classical texts by sort of strange idiosyncratic and very personal paths having more to do with the contemporary. And at the time when I began reading Virgil specifically, but the later, you know, Homer and Augustine and so forth, one thing that shocked me was I expected to dislike it. I expected that, you know, it would be all this sort of powerful male kind of, you know, I brought all these kind of fairly shallow, actually, very youthful feminist preconceptions to my reading, and they were all kind of shattered. I found that I loved reading these texts, and the language was so beautiful, and I couldn't put it down. And to me, suddenly reading Virgil's eclogues was, you know, it was the most beautiful thing. And so I also felt a sort of like guilt about my own identification with these texts. So all of these things, my preconceptions, my pleasure, my guilt, my criticality, all sort of, I've tried to find ways to bring them all together and find ways to inhabit a voice at the same time that I could use it critically. So, yeah, it became the way I wrote three books. And it's still a way that I continue to work, not as not in such extended forms as I used to, because I kind of did that, got that out of the way, wrote my epic. So now it's kind of more situational, small. Smaller incursions,
but it's a little bit. I mean, the story is like a small poem also, and it's actually very interesting to take the Odyssey and to make like a circle, this kind of weird appendix where it's happen, like it's circling, and to make like a very ellipse,
mm-hmm.
and still relate to this kind of story, like
mm-hmm.
enormous thing, you know.
Yeah,
I wrote that sentence with a question mark, material temporality of embodiment. But I think it's a sentence I heard, I think, in an interview about the Three Summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember, I think you said that this book has something to do with material temporality of embodiment. And it actually opens me, I mean, if I can reopen this conversation, that we're in, the question of rhythm in your work. And
yeah, another way to say that is aging.
Aging. Okay,
you know.
Material temporary. Aging, okay.
Aging.
Aging.
Is a fact.
Yeah.
If you don't die, you age.
Yeah.
And my best friend had just died.
Oh, shit.
At the time when I was writing this. And
oh, you speak about Stacey Doris.
Yeah, Stacey Doris, yeah. She was someone I collaborated with a lot. And we both were sick at the same time, but she was really, really sick, and I was only tiny little sick.
Mm-hmm.
But we experienced our illness in tandem, and I healed and she died.
Mm-hmm.
So it was... huge content in my emotional life.
Mm-hmm.
Big.
Yeah.
It was just a horrible wall of grief. So a lot of those poems are just working through that.
You know? Yeah.
Just trying to take on this experience of, okay, you know.
Yeah, sure.
this is not ongoing. It's going to end.
Yeah.
So what do we do with our bodily experience? Mm-hmm. I think that my younger experience of representing material embodiment had a great deal to do with pleasure and play and erotics. And there was a real freedom for me in grouping those ideas and experiences together. And it gave me a way to read, and it gave me a way to work. But, you know, then suddenly here I was 50, you know, dealing with the things that you deal with when you're 50, which is that your friends are dying,
mm-hmm.
you know. And, you know, lots of people die by the time you're 50. Now, mm-hmm. I'm not going to die, ever. However, it tears you up. Every year, a couple more friends die.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do then with your stance of, you know, pleasure and joy and embodiment? When embodiment is actually about ending.
Mm-hmm.
As well. So these poems are basically working in that field and also trying to make light of it in certain ways.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's these funny conversations that Stacey and I used to have about toxins and,
yeah.
you know, there's this whole theory of healing that if you just get rid of toxins that you'll become some sort of ethereally pure, ultimately healthy person, and will you know, eternally evade death and illness and unhappiness, everything. All you have to do is get rid of the toxins by drinking a lot of carrot juice and going to a Chinese, you know, traditional doctor and
yeah.
taking these herbs, and then the rules on how you get rid of the toxins keep changing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Eat this, don't eat that, you know. So these kinds of conversations took on this kind of hilarious morbidness. So there's a kind of very dark humor in in that too that that I tried to make space for.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, it was actually. Of course, I mean, I was at the reading also, and I really like the reading of the quote. But when I read that sentence I didn't read it, I think I heard it in the interview, as I said, material temporality of embodiment, I was thinking about more the question of rhythm, and this conversation that we have, and I think it's going to make this like circle, like about how Baroque music in the composition is also very linked to variation and repetition, and the way your texts are recycling themselves also.
Certainly this text does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it in
I'm
Erzbot?
Much more interested
in also in Erzbot, yeah, also.
Yeah, there's this form that I use in Cinema of the Present. I've used it three times. The first was in a poem that was in here called, what was it called? Something, draft for something, something. Why don't I have normal tables of contents in my books? You know? Something like draft for a split screen video loop. Draft of a voiceover for a split screen video loop. So the form was kind of invented, I think. I forget if
this
it was here or in Erzbot.
Oh, okay.
So they're both little, they're both short experiments using this form. And because I really liked the form, I wanted to see if it would work for a single long manuscript. So that's why one of the reasons I wrote Cinema of the Present, because I just wanted to see if the form would work. It's kind of alternating repetition. So, yeah, it's a very, you know, highly structured loop. Generally speaking, though, my interest in rhythm has more to do with irregularity. And in terms of the relationship between form and embodiment, my experience is that that's a radically irregular ongoing development in relationship, that there's practically nothing tidy or resolved or
Actually it's just like I told you about the fact that I was thinking about Baroque also because I was making this this link with actually I don't know why Couperin, because his use of the ornament is the grace note, his use of the grace note, and actually he's making a use of grace note as something very he write it actually that is not usual, and he's making something like very it's kind of the same level to the main harmony, actually. And as I was thinking of that, actually, I was thinking about what you say in your essay about, you know, the prosody of citizenship and how prosody is chanté à côté. And I make this thing about how something that we consider to be on the side can be really an agency in itself, you know. But I was thinking we can have a little Baroque pose. Can we do that?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So it's just an extract, and it's called Les Agréments, actually. And it's, yeah. I will put it again. So it was an interpretation from Blandine Verlet, I think. And it's actually an order. It's a suite, but it's called an order. It was published in an essay he wrote called L'art de toucher le clavecin, where it's a pedagogical book, actually, for children. Mm-hmm. And where his thing is to explain to the children how to finger the clavecin, is the expression, actually, how to mm-hmm. doiter le clavecin. And he tried to learn then to tremble.
Hmm.
And I think it's very beautiful, actually. Hmm. But it's also the thing that there is all this indication about how something that was not really specified so clearly in the Baroque music about the agrément, that really is about, actually, that how this thing can be really, like, taking really part in the harmony and not only, but, yeah. So that makes me think of Benveniste and your thing you wrote in the kneeling untitled essay, and what you said about how a citizenship can be a prosody. Mm-hmm. How to, like, this theory of prosody of citizenship and how mm-hmm. the citizen, like in this translation, I think you say that citoyen, like, is different from concitoyen, actually, mm-hmm. and how.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that's from Benveniste's work on the vocabulary of Indo-European institutions.
We can finish here, I think. I mean, it's been like an hour and a half, or not, almost 2 hours that we...
Yeah.
I mean, up to you.
I'm feeling a little tired.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. This is the end.
Thank you,
Lisa.
Thank you.
What about the Kunyaman?
This beautiful textile piece. What is the story?
This thing?
We did it in Trégnac, actually, at Sam. You know, like
it's great.
We all did it together. And it's like what it's wrote, Class Fantôme,
uh-huh.
because we were like reading this manga book. What was the name? The Grief King. Yeah, it's a manga, and it was the name of the workshop that we did at Sam.
Yeah,
in Trégnac, and so we made this.
There's one side in Japanese.
Yeah, one side is in Japanese. One is in
Sabrina, can I ask some questions? I felt you were aiming for something that you'd seen in Lisa's work. I feel I'm...
Yeah, go.
Both of you. We have... lots of, I'm relatively new to your work, so I might awkwardly tread on things. But the presence of Lucretius, who writes about the universe and the atom, and you were talking earlier about lists and interrupting and starting again, which is a very particular world of solid objects.
Mm-hmm.
And what Sabrina seems to be spotting is something which puts the relation first. There's always a becoming.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to draw on the text because I find it really irritating when you reread it, and I can't find it bits, but there's where elements or people are reaching out to become something. There's always, in the list, a disintegration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is something I find very interesting in your work, that even though there seems to be this structural modernist use of the present tense, there's something else going on, which I think is very very interesting, particularly in relationship to some of the people working with quantum theory, and that there are no for instance, there's no object, it's only the act of measurement that creates either a wave or mm-hmm. a particle. And before that moment of object, there is something relational that exists. It mm-hmm. doesn't tumble into one or the other. Mm-hmm. Of course, that becomes interesting in terms of subjectivities, that there's not mm-hmm. a discovering mm-hmm. of I, but a kind of context. And therefore, this mm-hmm. question of education that you mentioned, where the learning is not just the passing of a piece of information, this is a cup, but the cup becomes a cup through the group's use and decision towards mm-hmm. it. And so the meaning isn't held in objects. And I think this mm-hmm. tension seems to be something that we're bringing up quite often. I don't know what to do with that, but...
What your observation makes me think of is within avant-garde discourse around art and writing and so forth, and especially coming out of a history of use of Marxist critique within experimental aesthetics, we use the word materiality all the time. It's agreed upon that it's a value, it's a term, and people speak of language in terms of materiality, they speak of practices in terms of materiality, textual materiality, etc. But I've actually found myself getting more and more interested in the idea of immateriality mm-hmm. because I'm more interested in relationships than substantives, and in terms of what I want writing to contain is more a possibility of containing traces of relationships and their mutability. And it seems to me that that's what language does. That's what it does so beautifully when we speak together, or when we compose and when we read, is like we're changed by it constantly. We change one another. We agree to be changed by language, and so it's that immaterial energy that seems more and more important for me to notice and to try to speak about.
Yeah.
And because of our kind of institutional agreements, generally speaking, about this concept of materiality, and it comes up constantly. Like, I'm going to be going to a conference in Calgary in Canada, an art writing conference, and so there's going to be like Maria Fusco and people who do art writing. And so I'm on a panel they've asked me to be on a panel about materiality and performativity, and so there's like these words that we use and that get pulled out. And I find myself getting more and more ornery about them. I don't feel in agreement about the use of these words. I mean, I want to try to expand the vocabulary of thinking so that maybe, something else could come into it. And in terms of even speaking of, I mean, I think that the idea of materiality probably comes from Marx. But even so, there's this interesting earlier Marx where Marx was working on Lucretius and Democritus and Epicurus, where more of a...
Yeah, I think this seems to be the interesting thing. And also, as you say, there's everybody striving to become materialist in their thinking, and of course it's very hard to then try and propose a slightly different idiom when people might presume that you're heading backwards to something else rather than what I feel is very much in line with...
God forbid that one is being, romantic or idealist. Yes. No, never.
And you also, I think, the hint about the epic form, I also quite like that as a form that I associate with creating histories, writing a history.
Mm-hmm.
And, but in different people's hands, it proposes a new history, and I quite like it as a kind of counter-hegemonic structure
mm-hmm.
as well. And so they should be seized. And I very much like
yeah.
the long form, particularly of the cinema, that will sort of blend all the way through because of its kind of claim and jump to write a new history to
mm-hmm.
against the ones that we receive.
Well, you want to play with the received ones at the same time, you know. I mean, inhabit them against the grain of intention, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But I mentioned this earlier about when I began to read classical literature, for example, that my expectations were that I would dislike it. That I would find all kinds of things to irritate me and that I could then react against and so forth. And then in my actual reading of it, I, you know, fell in love with these texts. And it's that kind of equivocation that interests me linguistically and formally, and it feels like this is literature makes a space for this kind of equivocation. Where, you know, there's a feeling of expansive pleasure in reading and in encountering a text. But within that pleasure, there's also specific vantage points to open up critical spaces which work actually against the grain of tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, I mean, I'm interested in both things. I mean, I although I'm definitely a writer whose work gets placed within an avant-garde practice, I'm not interested at all in rejecting tradition
mm-hmm.
and rejecting canons. I'm interested in opening them.
Yeah.
That continuity is very interesting to me.
I mean, for me, the return to the classical is what for me, what the classics were about were about certain relationships to ideals, beauty,
mm-hmm.
the gods, and the questions of how do we restructure ourselves, how do we propose new forms of society, require for us to construct. Make things so we don't. It's not just a question now. I don't think we're in a period where we are just deconstructing and undermining. And I mean, this is perhaps what's become a problem with the left is that it's been undermining power, but not constructing anything. And so I very much enjoyed that. Though I've never read any classical things, but somehow their return there seems to be timely.
Yeah, one thing I've been reading a lot lately of I've been reading a lot of medieval poetry. I've been reading troubadour poetry, and one of the things that interests me a lot in that work, and I'm speaking like specifically of sort of 11th to 13th century sort of, you know, pure troubadour, right? Not as a kind of general wandering category. But one of the things that really interests me about that poetry is how it serves to contain and perhaps transmit certain values that were part of a cultural milieu
mm-hmm.
surround that has since vanished. And these values had to do with human relationships. And so that we can, because the culture that these values pertain to disappeared
mm-hmm.
as a result of the Albigensian Crusade and the destruction of this social life in this area of what wasn't then yet France.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know what the words mean,
oh.
but we still have the words. And so the poems are actually functioning as these artifacts which preserve certain mysteries as present about a history of potential ways of relating with other people, socially and personally. And so it's something I started thinking about it because I've been reading Jacques Roubaud's work on the troubadour poets, and it's something he talks about a little bit. So this question of values as being a sort of positive content,
yeah,
which literature and other cultural productions carry forward, but values in a sense of not some sort of, you know, fundamentalist closure,
no, yeah,
but as a set of open potentials. Mm-hmm. It seems really absolutely pertinent to me.
Yeah.
And, there's a point in my life where I never would have imagined hearing myself say that. Ever.
Exciting.
Why not? Death is all around us, right?
That's what was the interest.
And I say that not from the position of having any answers,
mm-hmm,
at all,
yeah,
but it just seems to me that this is one of the things that poems can do.
Yeah.
So, how can that be opened up?
Yeah.
How can, I'm interested in seeing, can I find a way to talk about that which doesn't come across as being reactionary?
Okay, yeah.
And which actually opens to new potentials of how to compose poems,
mm,
and how to think poems.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to come back to so many things, but we'll be here all night, so in the future. Certainly, Sabrina's question about practice and there's too many questions.
Okay, okay. We keep going on that.
I'll send you.
You are not staying?
No, I have to.
You take the train tonight?
Not tonight, no.
Oh, okay.
No.
Okay. If nobody wants you to ask question, we should just.
Thank you very much.
Oh wow.
Thanks for inviting me.
Very battery.
Mm.
That's the point.
You have to go. You cannot have a dinner with us or something.
One thing.